Hello, it's the 2nd of September. I'm John Dennis. Today I'm at Tate Modern for the launch of the 10-10 Climate Campaign. The Guardian's among the many companies and individuals pledging to reduce their carbon emissions by 10% by the end of next year. You'll be hearing from some of them, including Michael Rosen, Jeremy Hardy, Sarah Cox, and Ken Livingstone.
Use public transport more, walk and cycle more. Don't flush the toilet if you've only had a pee.
I'm hoping by signing up to 1010 that I can make a tiny little difference. And if everybody makes a tiny little difference, we'll make a lovely big sparkly difference.
We'll hear from the front line of global warming, the melting ice of Greenland.
We realise that the glaciers had accelerated not just by a little bit, by a lot.
And in other news, 70 years after the outbreak of the Second World War, a war of words over the origins of the conflict.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, it's Bill Overton with the news headlines.
It's been revealed Gordon Brown and Foreign Secretary David Miliband didn't want the Lockerbie bomber to die in prison. Documents were published yesterday showing the Libyans had been told this. Foreign Office Minister Bill Rammell admitted that he had said as much, but had insisted that it was only the Scottish Government that could make the decision to free him on compassionate grounds. The opposition leader David Cameron seized on the information to accuse the government of double-dealing. He says they had publicly told the Americans they wanted al-Megrahi to stay in prison, but told the Libyans the opposite. Today, the Scottish government will come under further attack as the Scottish Parliament debates the release. The United Nations reports poppy production's fallen by a fifth in Afghanistan. The biggest drop is in Helmand province, where British troops have been fighting. The Taliban is deeply involved in the production of poppies for heroin. Afghanistan is still the world's largest producer of the illegal drug. Liberal leader Nick Clegg says young soldiers should get a pay rise to encourage troops fighting in Afghanistan. He wants to see the most junior ranks being paid the same starting pay as someone serving in the police and fire service. It would mean an increase of up to £6,000 for some recruits. Firefighters in California believe they've beaten back the blaze threatening Los Angeles, but they fear worse may be to come in the usual wildfire season. California is also threatened by a hurricane, which is now moving up across Mexico. The Sirius morning papers all lead with the Lockerbie documents, which The Independent calls a new political storm. The Times says the Lockerbie paper trail leads to Gordon Brown. The Telegraph follows the Tory lead and calls it Brown's double dealing over Lockerbie. It goes on to describe how ministers eased the path for the Lockerbie bomber to be freed in an attempt to forge a relationship with Libya. There are several other front page stories, though. The Guardian, of course, gives space to its new ecological 10-10 campaign with a story about how Britain has become a nation of guilty greens, people who admit they don't do enough to fight climate change. The Sun gives us a full page picture of what it calls a squalid shack in the Afghan badlands, where it says British soldiers have been forced to wash for the past 2 years. What a bloody shower. Reads the headline. There's more news and sport throughout the day on guardian.co.uk.
I'm here in the Tate Modern's Turbine Hall at the end of the great big slope going down into the middle of it, and there's the launch of 1010. A host of famous names have gathered to launch the campaign. You'll be hearing from some of them throughout this programme. The campaign unites energy companies and environmental activists, a Premier League football club, Tottenham Hotspur, celebrities, NGOs and politicians. And it's asking individuals and organisations to sign a pledge to reduce their carbon emissions by 10% by the end of next year. It was the brainchild of the filmmaker behind The Age of Stupid, a powerful crowd-funded docudrama about our failure to tackle climate change.
My name's Franny Armstrong, and as of about 2 months ago, I was the director of The Age of Stupid, but now I seem to be some kind of founder of this 1010 campaign. Which one of those goes on my gravestone, I can't yet tell you.
Well, what is the idea? And, you know, tell us a bit about the ideas behind it.
It's a very simple idea. 1010, we're asking everybody in the UK to commit to cutting 10% of their emissions next year, i.e. in 2010. So whether you're an individual, a family, a school, a business, the monarchy, the military, everybody to commit, say, yes, I'm ready to cut 10%, which is, firstly, very easy. The first 10% is at the level of turning down your heating, driving a bit less, flying a bit less. So anybody can do it. But what we hope to do is then create a critical mass of people so that we can then challenge the government and say, look, the people of Britain are ready now we need you to seriously cut, commit to seriously cutting the whole country's emissions. And then the even bigger dream, one level further on, is that that means the UK could go to Copenhagen, the climate summit in December, and say, you know, as one of the biggest polluters, we know we're prepared to step forward and just start doing what's right, start doing what the science says, and just potentially it might just break the deadlock, because the history of the negotiations has always been it's America's fault, it's China's fault, nobody will ever move. If we carry on like that, then we're all going to be headed for a climate catastrophe. So it's a long shot, but we thought all of life on Earth is at stake, so give it a go.
That's Frenny Armstrong. Well, I'm at Tate Modern, looking over the turbine hall now up on the mezzanine level, overlooking a queue of people, members of the public, queuing up to sign up to the 1010 campaign on a bank of computers at the end of the turbine hall here. And at The Guardian today, we publish an ICM poll that tries to gauge public opinion on climate change. How serious are voters taking global warming? To what extent are they taking responsibility for it? Back at The Guardian's HQ, Julian Glover, our chief leader writer, has the details.
Most people in Britain do think climate change exists. In fact, even in 2005, about 80-85% of people thought it existed, pretty much the same today. And the majority of those do think it's a threat for future generations. Some also think it's a threat now. Going on from that, we then ask people, what was the cause of climate change? There's been quite a lot of pressure in some parts of the media to say it's not really just a man-made thing, it's a natural thing, maybe from volcanoes or the sun or something that politicians and the public can't tackle. Well, everybody rules that out. Over 70% of people think climate change is a man-made threat to the world. So if it is a threat and it is man-made, what can we do to fight it? Well, the poll then looked at various aspects of human behaviour. Some of those we came to in 2005, and not surprisingly, people still think if they drive a bit less, if they change light bulbs, if they do things like turning down their heating, all of that will make their commitment to carbon and they'll help fight climate change. But there is a bit of an uncertainty, really, as to whether it is down to individuals or really down to the state and to international governments and big business. So 52% of people think that although climate change exists and is a problem, they themselves, how they behave, won't in the end be the deciding factor. So they're a bit uncertain as to whether it needs a much wider international agreement. Nonetheless, a pretty hefty 93% of people in Britain say they are green. They try and do their bit, even if they're not quite sure what their bit achieves. And almost two-thirds of those, I think about 61%, say, well, they do a bit of green things, but they probably ought to do more. And those, of course, the kind of people we're trying to engage in the 1010 campaign at the moment, people who are aware of the problem, maybe feel a bit guilty, maybe don't quite know what they need to do. One remarkable fact we came across was asked about wind farms. There's a lot of media talk about the problems of wind farms. They're ugly or maybe not effective. Well, most people actually don't object to their construction. Over 70% don't really mind if one's built within 20 miles of their house. And quite surprisingly, 67% actually say they wouldn't object if it was built in sight of their house, somewhere on the horizon, on a ridge or something like that. Now, of course, some of those people may just be feeling a bit guilty about not being green enough. They may not really want to say that they'd object, even though when it came to it, they would. But it does suggest some of that overwhelming media opposition to things like wind farms, things like low-energy light bulbs, isn't always borne out by what people actually say. And finally, one astonishing fact, 20% of people say they wouldn't mind a nuclear power station being built within sight of their house. Now, whether that really would be the case if planners came around and knocked on the door and said, put up a nuclear power station, I don't know. But there is a lot of public concern. There is a desire to do something. What this poll shows, I think, is people don't yet know what they can do.
Julian Glover. Well, back at the Tate Modern, Ian Katz is here. He's The Guardian's deputy editor, and he explains why The Guardian's involved.
Well, I think this is one of those issues that people feel incredibly kind of powerless and depressed about. They know it's really important. They know they should do something, but they can't figure out what on earth they can do that makes any difference at all to a problem that just seems so sort of hopelessly vast and intractable. So when Frenny Armstrong, who's the director of Age of Stupid, walked into my office and said, I've got this really good idea for a campaign, I first thought, God, that's completely bonkers. And then I thought, well, actually, that really is something that could allow lots of ordinary people like us, lots of our readers, to do something that actually amounts to something, that makes a meaningful difference. And I think what's so significant about this campaign and what really marks it out from all the others that are around, and there are lots of climate campaigns, is that it allows people to do something which is both meaningful, not footling, but is also achievable. It's not like being asked to turn your whole life upside down, never take another flight again, never boil a kettle. It's stuff real people can do that amounts to something meaningful, and it stands just a kind of chance, I think, of changing the kind of political landscape around this critical, critical moment of seeking a global deal in Copenhagen in December.
Ian Katz, and you can swap your tips on how to cut your emissions, and you can share your experiences and offer support at guardian.co.uk/1010. Also on The Guardian's website today, Stephen Fry writes about his interest in wildlife and his friendship with Douglas Adams, who's inspired him to make a documentary on his search for endangered species. guardian.co.uk/environment/wildlife. We've got an extract from the new Mum's Net book, A Guide to Surviving Pregnancy, at guardian.co.uk/women. And Ryan Gilby on Disney taking over Marvel Comics, guardian.co.uk/arts. We're at Tate Modern in central London for the launch of 1010. Let's hear from another person who's signed up.
I'm Ken Livingstone. I'm a resting politician.
What's brought you to the Tate Modern today, Ken?
You don't have to wait for the Copenhagen Treaty or your government or your mayor. You next year can cut your carbon emissions 10% without in any way reducing the quality of your life. Insulate your loft. Use public transport more. Walk and cycle more. Don't flush the toilet if you've only had a pee. Buy less beef. I mean, not only fast carbon emissions, growing the feed for cattle, but the things produce methane, which is about 40 times more damaging as a carbon gas. So, I mean, it's all small changes. I mean, it's not the end of people's world if they have to have a bit more chicken and a bit less beef. The only reason our figures come down a bit over the last 20 years is the close of the mining industry. We really haven't. Take out the destruction of British industry. I mean, we have not reduced carbon emissions. They're actually going up now, I think, because the government's been too nervous to ask people to make lifestyle changes, and that's what Franny's campaign and Backed by the Garden is doing.
Surely the difference that an individual makes isn't going to make much difference to the big picture.
No, but if a billion do it, and that's why campaigns like this matter, and also if politicians see individuals doing it, more of them will be inclined to grow a backbone and start taking the sort of measures that we need to see governments taking. I mean, privately, I've talked to so many government ministers over the last few years. They're all terrified of being seen to be asking people to reduce the quality of their life. And what this campaign is showing is you don't reduce the quality of your life at all. You cut out the waste. This isn't, we could actually call it cut the waste 10%, you know.
Ken, many thanks.
From guardian.co.uk, this is Guardian Daily.
My name's John Dennis. Thank you very much. Thank you. This is Guardian Daily. I'm standing outside the Tate Modern now. There's some speeches going on. Some bands going to be playing in a short while in a stage that's been erected beside the Thames here. But still to come, Jeremy Hardy, Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall, Sarah Cox and Michael Rosen tell us why they're supporting the 1010 campaign.
There can't be much point in just watching that my taps aren't dripping or that the telly's off at night if there isn't some major political change as a consequence. So that's the bit where I'm holding my breath, which of course helps global warming as well.
But first, 10% is also the proportion of the world's population living in areas vulnerable to a 1 meter rise in sea levels. That's 600 million people. One such area is Sermalik Fjord in Greenland, from where Patrick Barkham reports.
It's calving season on the fjords of Greenland. There are icebergs, the shapes of swans, UFOs, some as smooth as dinosaur eggs, others as rough as Gothic castles. And they're all splintering off the huge glaciers that reach down from the Greenland ice cap. It looks beautiful, but if the world keeps warming, it's going to get very dirty. This is the front line of climate change. The Arctic is warming faster than most other parts of the world. If the Greenland ice sheet was to melt, sea level would rise by 7 meters around the globe. It's not simply that a rise in temperature caused by greenhouse gases is making the ice melt. Rather, this melting is triggering all kinds of new effects which are speeding up the changing of our climate and speeding up sea level rise. I catch up with Gordon Hamilton, a polar glaciologist from the University of Maine, at his base camp in Tasiilaq, a tiny settlement in eastern Greenland. 4 years ago, Hamilton daringly landed on a moving glacier and used GPS to discover its speed. He found it had accelerated from 7 kilometres a year to nearly 12 kilometres, showing it was melting faster than ever.
We realised that the glaciers had accelerated not just by a little bit, by a lot. So as glaciologists, you know, you could be perfectly content making your career of just trying to understand why a glacier like Helheim moves at 7 kilometres a year. And it had undergone this change in speed in probably, you know, a year or less than a year. There's two immediate possibilities. One, that it's just a short-term event and everything will go back to normal. And the other is that whatever triggered Helheim, Kangerluarsuk, Jakobshavn is another one on the west coast, to all change at around about the same time starts to affect all the other big outlet glaciers that drain the Greenland ice sheet. And if they all start to speed up, then you know, you could have you triple the speed of Kangerluarsuk Glacier, triple the rate that mass has been put into the ocean. If you do that for all the glaciers in Greenland, then you could have quite a large rise in sea level in the near term, much larger than the IPCC official estimate would project.
Oceanographer Fayama Strianyo is investigating a newly discovered cause of disappearing glaciers. They are not just melting from above by the warmer atmosphere, they are being melted from below. Fayama is taking the temperature of the oceans around several outflow glaciers.
The ice sheet has, you can think of them as little fingers, these are outlet glaciers that come out towards the ocean, and they do this through these fjords, they're deep, narrow fjords. When it enters, let's say the fjord that comes in contact with the ocean, is about 500 to 700 meters deep. So there's a very thick layer of ice that's beneath the surface of the ocean. And it gets to about 4 degrees at 400 or 500 meters. And this warm and salty water is of subtropical origin, carried by the Gulf Stream into the high latitudes. And we think this is one of the mechanisms that has caused these outlet glaciers to accelerate and shed more ice.
Patrick Barker reporting. Well, as you can hear, the bands have started up now, and a number of leading artists and writers are supporting the 1010 campaign, including a former children's laureate.
I'm Michael Rosen, and I write mostly children's books, but not entirely so.
Does it make you nervous, the prospect of making a 10% cut in your emissions?
No, it doesn't make me nervous. I think what I'm thinking is I'll do it so long as we think that there can be some political payoff. There can't be much point in just, watching that my taps aren't dripping or that the telly's off at night if there isn't some major political change as a consequence. So that's the bit where I'm holding my breath, which of course helps global warming as well.
And, what role do you think that children could play, apart from just sort of understanding what the issues are?
It's quite tricky with kids, isn't it? Because you don't want them to be in a state of blind panic, but at the same time you want them to think this one through. I mean, it's adults who've screwed the world up, not kids. And I sometimes get worried that sometimes we heap these campaigns on children and children don't necessarily have the resources to realise they're not to blame. So they can quite easily get into worrying about bottle tops and things like that, as if somehow or other it's their fault. Well, it isn't.
The great Michael Rosen, and later we'll be hearing from some of the children supporting the 1010 campaign.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
Well, we've come back inside the Tate Modern now. The bands have started up outside. Just across the Thames from where we are now at St Paul's Cathedral, more than 2,000 people attended a special service earlier today to remember the 70th anniversary of the evacuation. These were children who were sent out of Britain's cities as war began. Well, meanwhile, world leaders attended a ceremony at the Westerplatte Peninsula, the site of Nazi Germany's opening assault on Poland, to mark the 70th anniversary of the outbreak of the Second World War. Among those paying tribute to the millions who lost their lives were the German Chancellor Angela Merkel and the Polish President Lech Kaczynski. But there's been fierce disagreement about who, apart from Hitler, was to blame for starting the war, with the Baltic states saying Stalin's Soviet Union was equally at fault. Luke Harding's in the Guardian's Moscow bureau.
Yesterday's gathering on Poland's Baltic coast to mark the 70th anniversary of the beginning of the Second World War should have been a sort of solemn occasion. There were all the usual European heads of state there, prime ministers and presidents But in fact, the whole event was absolutely hijacked by this bitter and acrimonious row going on at the moment between Russia on one hand and the former sort of client states, if you like, of the Soviet Union on the other. Now, what we've seen over the summer is really a kind of furious exchange between the Baltic states in particular and Moscow over the Second World War, and in particular, the legacy of Stalinism and the Red Army. Now, what the Baltics said, they passed a resolution through the OSCE's Parliamentary Committee in July, is that Stalinism was just as bad as Nazism. After all, bear in mind, they suffered from a very long occupation of about 40 years by the communists after the Nazis had been kicked out. Now, the Russians say that this is false, they say this is wrong, and they've launched a vehement propaganda campaign against what they describe as the falsification of history. And what we saw yesterday were these sort of two different versions of history clashing, if you like, with Vladimir Putin representing Russia, saying that when Stalin signed the infamous pact with Hitler in August 1939, this was merely one in a series of kind of tactical agreements that a whole range of powers, including Great Britain, France, and Poland, had signed with the Nazis. Of course, the Poles don't see it that way at all. They want the Russians to apologise for a whole series of atrocities, including the massacre of Polish officers in Katyn in 1940, which was one of the most infamous incidents of the war, and for the Soviet Union's invasion of Poland in September 70 years ago.
Isn't it clear who started the war?
Now, that's a very interesting question. I've just come from a press conference in Moscow where Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service, the SVR, has released a whole sheaf of documents which it says proves that in the run-up to the war, Poland basically sided with the Nazis, that they pacted with the Nazis and that they were plotting essentially to kind of destabilize and undermine Stalin's Soviet Union by supporting separatists in Ukraine and Georgia and so on. Now, really, there were quite astonishing scenes at this press conference. There was a retired KGB Major General, Lev Sotskov, who was giving it and waggling various documents in front of us. And the Polish journalist sitting in front of me stood up angrily and started sort of exchanging angry words with him. One of the bones of contention was that Sotskov produced a document written by a Soviet agent in 1934, which allegedly showed that Poland had signed a sort of secret neutrality pact with the Nazis. Now, historians I've spoken to have said there's no evidence for this. The Polish journalists were furious, and it seems at the moment there's no sense that this row is going away. Ultimately, of course, this isn't really just a row about history and the events of 70 years ago. It's a row about now, and it's a row in particular about what sort of a relationship there should be between Russia, which under Putin and Dmitry Medvedev, Russia's president, has been going in a very kind of strongly nationalist direction, some might say. The relationship between Russia and the Eastern Europeans and those who live in the Baltic and those who live in what used to be, of course, the sort of Soviet Empire. Now, Russia says vehemently that it's entitled to a sphere of influence in countries surrounding it, in post-Soviet countries, and that it's entitled to have a say in who runs these countries, what kind of direction they have, whether they're entitled to join NATO and other Western transatlantic institutions. Now, of course, the West, the US, the European Union say that that's just not the case. We had the war last year in Georgia, and now there are really very ominous rumblings that there could be another potential conflict with Ukraine, which is central to this new Kremlin doctrine, that it has a kind of a right, if you like, to influence its neighbours, especially ahead of Ukraine's presidential election, which takes place in January.
That's Luke Harding. Well, in a few minutes, we'll hear how the Cayman Islands, known as a tax haven, is on the verge of going bust.
The Foreign Office actually is telling them, ironically, to think about taxing people, which is highly ironic given the fact that the Caymans is in fact a tax haven.
But first, let's hear from some more people who've pledged to reduce their emissions by 10% before the end of 2010.
Jeremy Hardy, and I'm an entertainer, and I've been roped in as a bit of celebrity skirt for the day.
And are you going to be reducing your emissions? That's the big question.
I shall try to. I don't think we use a lot of carbon. I'll turn the heating down a bit because I tend to like a warm house, And we haven't had a foreign holiday for a long time, so I don't use planes much. But we'll see if we can get another 10% down. People are saying, well, all right, we will do our bit on the basis that governments are going to have to do their bit as well. I think if you're just saying to people, oh, lag your loft and don't put much water in your kettle, people get fed up. But if they feel there is a genuine momentum and that maybe there will be an agreement, then people are happy to sort of try and help.
I'm Hugh Fernie Whittingstall and I'm here to support 1010.
What can foodies do?
Foodies can shop more locally. Better still, they can grow a little bit of their own food. We're trying to make it easier for people to do that. We have a fantastic project called Landshare now, which I think dovetails very nicely with 1010, which is a website that enables people who want to grow food to find land to do it on near them. It's sort of like a dating agency between people who've got spare land and people who want to grow food. And all the things that you can do for the environment to do with food tend to be things that bring you pleasure as well.
You're already doing many of those things, Hugh. Is reducing your emissions by 10% going to be something that you're going to find difficult?
Well, I suppose, speaking slightly cynically, you could say the timing suits me rather well, because I'm about to get a wind turbine installed at home, which I hope will bring down my carbon footprint and indeed my fuel bills pretty drastically. So I'm hoping to do nearer 50%+.
My name's Sarah Coggs. I'm DJ, broadcaster, international style icon and mother of two. And the latter is kind of why I'm here, because I'm a mum. I think for my kids and for my kids' kids, I kind of want to leave, well, a world, and if possible, a safer, cleaner world where they can breathe the air and where they're not in danger from floods. And it's just over the last couple of years, so I've just become much more aware of my actions and, you know, what the consequences are of how much energy I use and how clean I am. So I'm hoping by signing up to 1010 that I can make a tiny little difference. And if everybody makes a tiny little difference, we'll make a lovely big sparkly difference.
Sarah Cox. Well, the Cayman Islands, which has survived for years as a tax haven, is on the verge of bankruptcy. They may even have to ask their citizens to pay taxes for the first time. Back at the Guardian's offices, business reporter Nick Mathieson is on the line. Nick, what are the problems facing the Cayman Islands?
Well, the biggest problem it's facing is that it's almost going bust. They haven't got enough revenues against their expenditure. They've seen a huge withdrawal of hedge fund industry and other financial institutions, and they need to borrow $310 million, which they requested the Foreign Office for permission to do so. The Foreign Office turned them down, so they now need permission to raise emergency funds of $30 million just to pay their staff. They can't afford to pay their staff. Last month, they couldn't pay their pensions and their private medical bills and various other issues. They couldn't pay their contractors and general suppliers. So they really are in financial crisis.
And how did they get into this mess?
Well, I guess part of the problem is the financial crisis. Financial institutions have been exiting the Caymans. They rely on a small amount of money from them. They don't actually pay taxes to the Cayman Islands, but they pay a small fee towards them. So they've seen a hemorrhaging of that. They've probably seen a downturn in their tourism industry as well. They've also been expanding lots of new buildings to encourage financial institutions into the island. So all that expenditure, all those kind of commitments, is now closing in on them.
And what are the options now for the authorities?
Well, the options, I guess, are to dramatically cut expenditure. But the Foreign Office actually is telling them, ironically, to think about taxing people, which is highly ironic given the fact that the Caymans is, in fact, a tax haven.
Has the decision by the G20 to crack down on tax havens had any effect on the problems now facing the Cayman Islands authorities?
Well, to a certain extent, it may have contributed a part of this, in the sense that wealthy people are now doing deals with tax authorities. We've seen that happen in America. We're beginning to see that in Britain and also in other European countries. So, in a sense, the G20 focusing on tax havens to a big degree has impacted on the Caymans. But really, I guess it's the financial crisis in its full grisliness that is affecting them.
Nick Mathieson. Well, back at the Tate Modern, I spoke to Janet Convery, head of schools and youth engagement at the campaigning charity ActionAid.
Some schools have already done a lot. They've done a lot with their children about the curriculum, and they've also looked at their school energy bills. On the website, you'll find a case study from Ashley School in Surrey, and they've already made over a 50% cut in their electricity bill in 1 year. And they'll also now be looking at their heating bill and also transport as well. And so we've picked up lots of advice from schools about how they do this. And that's our aim as well, is to be very practical for schools. It's very important that we have a generation of energy literate young people that value energy, monitor it and look after it as much as they value time.
We have solar panels on the roofs, so it powers all our energy. We have a biomass boiler which is run on wood pellet, so it's more expensive but it's better for the environment.
In our classroom we have solar light tubes, so when we're working we don't need the lights on if it's a sunny day.
Guardian Daily, news from the Guardian.
So we've got a bank of computers here, lots of people signing up, and now it's time for me to add my name. And here's how you can do it. You can go to 1010uk.org and sign up. It's asking for your name, your email address, your city, and that's it. You commit. That's it. Let me do it. I'm going to do it now. John. I won't tell them my middle name. John Dennis. Okay, and that's it. Commit. I've done it.
My name's Lucy. I'm a creative consultant and activist. I've just written some of these fantastic pink pledge cards. The first one was I'm going to be doing some more protesting and getting more active on CO2. But I'm also going to be avoiding bulky packaging and packaged foods. Because I think that's something I was looking in my bin this morning and just seeing how much ridiculously unwasteful packaging there is. And if you shop carefully, you can avoid that.
My name's Alex, I'm an event organiser.
How will you be reducing your emissions by 10%?
Tricky. I'm already kind of as low as I think I can go, but I think I'm going to try and be 100% vegan, which I'm not at the moment.
Good luck. Well, it's closing time at Tate Modern now. The bands are still playing, but we've been chucked out. We're at the front entrance now. And that's it from this special edition of Guardian Daily from Tate Modern. And don't forget, if you want to find out more, you can go to guardian.co.uk/1010. Full coverage there. Our producers today were Andy Duckworth and Tim Mabey. I'm John Dennis. Thanks for listening.